Hello, everyone, and welcome to 2018's last e-learning. Today, we have revisited a very, very popular topic. It's employment law myths, but it is the holiday edition. So before Christy and I get to the material today, I just want to start you off with a few reminders. First, if you have any questions at all during the presentation, please feel free to use the bottom right-hand side. There is a chat box there. You can type out your question. We will do our best to answer the question during our talk. We may not be able to get to it today because we are covering a lot of ground. If we don't get to it during our talk, we will be sure to follow up with you directly after the presentation. If you've missed any of our past webinars, and there's a number of them from this year, and they're all great, you can find them over at e2rsolutions.com. That's where the audio recordings will be. And you can find the actual slides for the PowerPoint presentations in your member portal. And lastly, as a reminder, the information that is contained in today's webinars and all of our webinars are meant to be an overview only, and it's not intended to be a legal analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as specific legal advice for any given situation. As always, we are here to help. If you have any specific questions or issues, please don't hesitate to reach out to our team, and we will schedule a call with an advisor to go through your issues. As a reminder, this is our last e-learning of the year. We'll be back on January 30th, 2019, so stay tuned for that. And let's get started. I'm going to pass it over to Christy, and she's going to get going. Actually, you know what? I'm going to keep going. Look at that.
I'll wait.
I'm already messing up on the last one. So we're going to go through the agenda really quickly, and then I'll pass it over to Christy. So we're going to be talking about a number of scenarios today, and kind of briefly, some of the topics we will be covering will be the hiring of fixed-term employees and seasonal employees, vacation entitlement as it relates to this time of year, also your kind of public holidays, eligibility, and the actual pay that goes along with that for this time of year, religious holidays, gift giving, company closures, everyone's favorite topic on the holiday party considerations, and we'll wrap it up with a nice little bow. So now I'll pass it over to Christy to talk about our first scenario.
Right. So on the topic of employment agreements, generally speaking, if we're hiring fixed-term employees or seasonal people to, you know, handle, in some cases, extra busy time of year, you know, they might be ending towards the end of the calendar year. So true or false, our fixed-term employees contract is ending December 31st, but we know we want to extend them. Since we're so busy right now, we'll just handle it in the new year and provide the paperwork then. No problem. You've probably heard us say this before on calls and in other presentations. This is absolutely false. Employees should not be working without a valid employment agreement. So any time that they are working past their end date that is in their employment agreement, you are opening yourself up to exposure. Any employee without an employment agreement outlining the termination entitlements is going to be entitled to common law reasonable notice of termination, which of course is going to be higher likely than what they would be entitled to under the provincial employment standards legislation. So as soon as you work past your end date, if we're talking about a fixed term person, that contract is ended and the termination provision with that end date is no longer going to govern. So it's important that they do not work past the end date of that agreement. It would be better, in fact, to delay their return to work, so have them maybe end on the end date and have maybe a gap between issuing a new employment agreement when they come back on those new terms. So it would be better to delay their return to work until a new agreement can be drafted, and keeping in mind in that case that prior service would need to be recognized in almost all cases. So you would give them credit for the time that they had been previously working under the old employment agreement. Once a fixed-term employee works beyond their termination date without a new agreement, the employer would need to offer fresh consideration for the employee to sign off on a new employment agreement. So we've probably talked to a lot of you guys about the concept of consideration, so offering them something in exchange for them signing off on a new agreement. So absent fresh consideration, the employee is going to be entitled to common law reasonable notice on termination instead of the provincial minimums, And like we said, that's usually going to be a much higher payout or notice period. So obviously much more exposure for the employer in that case. So as a best practice, just something to keep in mind, when we're coming up on the end date of any fixed term, whether it's at this time of year or otherwise, set a calendar reminder for yourself, like 2 to 3 weeks prior to the end of that agreement, so that you can draft whatever documentation is required, or we can draft it for you, obviously, whether that's extending their term, their agreement, or just confirming that that, in fact, will be the end date. So just put a reminder in there to make sure that that end date is not missed.
Our next scenario is going to deal with seasonal employees. As many of our retail clients know, they are ramping up for the Christmas and holiday season sales and store stuff, and they're hiring additional staff to manage that increased demand. This also applies to a lot of our recreational clients in the summertime. So keep this also in mind if you're one of those clients. But the scenario is we are hiring some staff to work over the holidays since we are so busy. Since they are only working for us for a couple of weeks or a couple of months even, they won't be covered by employment standards and we won't need to give them any vacation. Now, is that true or is that false? Well, I'm sure you can assume that that's going to be false. And employment standard legislation applies to all employees, regardless of their status as being a full-time, part-time, a seasonal, fixed-term employee. So seasonal fixed-term employees will have the same statutory entitlements or protections as all other employees. So whether they're being hired for a day or an hour, they will have the requisite kind of protections that will apply subject to any service requirements set out and employment standards. Now, specific to vacation, most provinces do require employees to work 12 months before they are entitled to vacation time. For our clients in Quebec, note that this is not the case in your province. Employees are entitled to 1 day per full month of uninterrupted service. That's vacation time. Now, vacation pay, as many of you know, is a separate entitlement to vacation time. And vacation pay is directly tied to wages earned, and therefore is payable as a percentage of all wages earned as of the first day of employment. Now, this can be paid in most jurisdictions, except for Quebec, on each paycheck, as long as the employee has authorized that kind of timing in writing. Alternatively, you can also pay that out at the end of the fixed term contract, again, assuming non-Quebec and also assuming that the fixed term is less than 12 months. And don't forget, very important is to have seasonal employees sign the appropriate fixed term employment agreement. We don't want to be left in a situation where there is some kind of notice owed at the end of the fixed term because it was an oral agreement, or if we want to end it early, we want to make sure that we have an early termination provision in there so we don't need to pay them out for the remainder of the term.
So the next scenario here is related to statutory holidays and the entitlement to the pay or the time or both. So we get a lot of questions here about, you know, if the holiday falls on a day that our employees are not usually working, so maybe a weekend or if they've got an irregular schedule throughout the week, what is that person's entitlement to the holiday if it's not falling on a regularly scheduled workday? So the scenario here, my part-time employees only work Wednesday to Friday every week. Since Christmas Day and New Year's Day, statutory holidays, both fall on a Tuesday this year, not week, sorry, and are therefore not regularly scheduled days of work for that employee, they are therefore not entitled to any statutory holiday pay. So this is also false. Entitlement to statutory holiday pay for a non-regular working day is going to depend on the minimum employment standards legislation of the province that the employee works in. So province by province here, we look at BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, where the holiday falls on an employee's regular day off, they are still entitled to be paid an average day's pay. Now, Alberta, just something to note, that was new in their legislation as of January 1st of 2018. So just something to make sure you are adhering to. Ontario, Quebec, and New Brunswick, where the statutory holiday falls on a non-working day, employees are entitled to either a substitute holiday off with holiday pay or holiday pay for the holiday. And that's if the employee agrees to have the holiday pay and not also the substitute day off. So just make sure that that's agreed to in writing. Manitoba, Prince Edward Island, Newfoundland, and Nova Scotia, where the statutory holiday falls on a day that the employee doesn't normally work, the employer has to give the employee a normal work day off with holiday pay. So you would substitute essentially a normal work day and give them holiday pay for that day. So different entitlements based on the province that they are working in. And in terms of the actual calculation of statutory holiday pay, just again, be careful that each jurisdiction is going to determine what that calculation is. And we'll talk about what the eligibility for that is on the next slide. So eligibility for holiday pay is based on the employee's date of hire, and in some cases, the number of days that the employee has worked before the holiday falls in some cases. So again, by way of reminder, eligibility for statutory pay is going to vary by province. All employees are going to be entitled, so full-time, part-time, fixed, casual, like Alex said, provided they meet these requirements. So Alberta, Ontario, Manitoba, and Quebec, employees are technically eligible immediately upon employment. And I say technically because if it's a formula that's based on, you know, their wages that they've earned in the certain number of weeks prior to the holiday, that number might not be a full day's pay, or it might be zero, but they are technically eligible immediately upon employment. BC and Prince Edward Island, the employee has to be employed for 30 calendar days before the statutory holiday, and they must have earned wages on 15 of the 30 days immediately before the statutory holiday. So you need to go back and count those out to make sure that they are in fact eligible. Nova Scotia is similar, the employee must be employed for 30 calendar days before the holiday and must be eligible to earn wages on 15 of those days. Newfoundland, they just need to be employed for 30 calendar days before the holiday. And just note that these are calendar days, not working days. New Brunswick, the employee has to be employed for at least 90 calendar days, not just work days, during the 12 months before the public holiday. Employees in most jurisdictions also are going to need to work their last scheduled shift before the holiday and their first scheduled shift after the holiday, absent, you know, a reasonable excuse for that, to be eligible for the holiday pay. And again, remember that employees who work on the statutory holiday, because we do have clients who are going to be open and require some staff for the various stats, that entitlement to additional pay and a substitute holiday is going to vary based on the province that they work in as well. If you've got questions, obviously, about the entitlement or how to calculate holiday pay, let us know. The calculation, like I said earlier, is going to be based on wages, and it's usually either a formula of some kind or a regular day's pay in some provinces. And just a note for our Ontario clients that formula changed this year. So it changed January 1st to a new formula, and then July 1st went back to the old formula, which is wages from the 4 weeks prior to the holiday divided by 20.
Now let's address the possibility of non-statutory holidays, and in particular religious holidays. It comes up all throughout the year, but it also may come up at this time of year as well, and into the new year for some of our Orthodox folks. And so the scenario is as follows. One of my employees is requesting a day off for a religious holiday. Since it's not a statutory holiday in our province, we don't have to grant this request. Is that true or is that false? Well, that's going to be false, because employees generally should be granted the time off, at least, to observe religious holidays. As many of you know, religion and creed is one of the protected grounds under provincial human rights legislation across our country. And because it's a protected ground, employers have a duty to accommodate requests for time off for religious reasons up to the point of undue hardship. We went through undue hardship on our last presentation in a lot of detail, so you can revisit that kind of general concept there. Now, employees could take this time off as unpaid, or they could request a vacation day or a personal day if that's available to them to avoid an interruption in earnings. And just a note on that, even though employers do typically control when an employee is able to take their vacation, I would strongly recommend allowing an employee to take vacation if it's available to them to cover a religious holiday, because I think there is the possibility that if you fail to allow them to do so, you could be running afoul with your obligations under human rights. So just keep that in mind, that if an employee requests a religious holiday and they do request the use of their available vacation time, there is no obligation to give them the day off with pay if that's not available to them. But if it is available to them, I would strongly urge that they be given that that request.
Gift giving. So this is maybe slightly outside of the employment scope, but somewhat related. We see a lot of gifts this year, obviously, employers to employees. So the question here is, if I give my employees a $200 gift card as a holiday gift, I do not need to report this as income. False. So Canada Revenue Agency has a lot of details on their site about what is considered to be taxable as it relates to gifts. So cash and near cash gifts. So near cash is going to be something that, like a gift certificate or a gift card. I mean, it's functioning as cash or actual cash, or something that can be converted to cash, so securities and stocks like we list here. So cash and near cash gifts and awards are always going to be taxable to the employee and should be reported as income on the T4. So if I'm giving my employee a $200 gift card or for whatever, that should be reported as income and added to their T4 statement at the end of the year. Employers can give what they call non-cash gifts. So that would include something like, you know, a watch or tickets or something to that effect for a combined value of up to $500 annually. So there's sort of an exemption that the CRA allows for up to $500 worth of non-cash gifts that would not be considered income. So in order to determine what should be considered income in that case, so I mean, maybe you're giving a gift that costs $600, you would subtract the $500 that's allowed, and the remaining $100 would be considered taxable. And important to note here that you should calculate the fair market value of the non-cash gift, not the actual cost. So, I mean, it doesn't cost the employer anything. It still obviously has a fair market value, and that's what we should be looking at when we're considering what amount needs to be considered income, if any. And just to note, too, this does not include small or trivial items or trivial value don't need to be included. So, you know, T-shirts with the logos, mugs, plaques, things like that don't need to be included in that calculation. And the CRA, like I said, does have a tool that will help employers determine if their gift is taxable. So we would strongly recommend that you check that as well if you've got questions about what that looks like, just as an additional resource. As a best practice, just as an aside, you might have an internal policy that addresses gift giving and potential conflicts of interest. So, you know, if you're getting gifts, for example, from vendors or, you know, clients or customers, it might be something that you already have. So it might be a good time to remind employees of what our expectations are of them regarding any gifts that they might receive from those outside parties. So, you know, is there a conflict of interest? Is there a policy about, we sometimes see, you know, gifts over a certain amount need to be reported to management. Some of our clients have policies that say gifts cannot be accepted at all. Some of our clients have gifts that say, you know, policies that say gifts over a certain amount need to be turned over to management so that they can be, you know, raffled off or shared among staff. So just the thought about reviewing your internal policies and seeing if it's been an issue in the past, just to see if that needs to be something we should address.
Before we get into our next topic on vacation, we did have a question about statutory holidays. In particular, and we don't know the actual jurisdiction, so the answer might not be the answer you're looking for. So again, if we're not answering your question correctly, or if you're not in Ontario, because I'm going to speak to, I'm going to assume it's Ontario right now, but if it's not Ontario, then we will reach out to you after the presentation. If you send us a quick note, we can sort it out. But the question was, If an employee works 4 weeks prior to the staff holiday but does not work either their regular day prior to or after the staff holiday, does the employer have to pay for that staff holiday? And again, the rules do vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but ordinarily, if the person does not work their regular shift before or after the holiday, they're not entitled to the public holiday pay. Now, if the employee calls in sick, then that would be a reasonable basis for not working in that shift, so they would still qualify in that scenario. Likewise, they don't need to work the day after or the day before if it's not their regular shift, it's their next regular shift. So that next regular shift for a part-time person could be 3 weeks after the holiday, I don't know. But if they don't work that shift for an unjust reason, then you don't have to pay. Now, the question really is, what's an unjust reason? And obviously, a no-call, no-show would definitely be something where you could refuse to pay the public holiday pay. If they're not in a province with available kind of on the personal emergency leave, you may be able to argue that there isn't an obligation, but it is going to be very fact specific. And so if there's a particular scenario that does arise and you're unsure whether or not there is a public holiday pay obligation, please don't hesitate to reach out to us and we will help you navigate through that issue.
We've got another question here just about the non-cash gifts and what would be considered income. So that $500 is the exemption. So anything over that would be considered income. And that's for non-cash gifts. So again, things like, you know, watches, items like that, tickets, whatever the case is. So anything over that $500 would be considered income.
So the next topic is vacation. And this obviously is an issue that arises year round, but definitely comes to a head at year end under a number of scenarios. And so we have one of the kind of more common scenarios that comes up at year end is as follows. Our scenario is any employee who has not used their 2018 vacation entitlement by the end of the year will forfeit any unused days since we have a use it or lose it policy. Now that answer is going to be false. An employee is not permitted to lose their minimum amount of vacation time and pay. You can have a use it or lose it policy, essentially saying if you don't use X amount of vacation by the end of the year, you lose it. For anything over and above the minimum statutory entitlement, but an employee cannot waive by virtue of a contract or a policy or some separate document their rights to their minimum amount of vacation time and pay. And we also wanted to double check the actual jurisdiction about use it or lose it policies, because I seem to recall that there are some jurisdictions where that is not even appropriate as well. It is your responsibility, as a reminder, to ensure employees take the minimum vacation time required as per minimum employment standards legislation or make alternative arrangements as permitted under legislation in which the province where they operate. So, for example, allowing them to kind of push back the vacation time and pay into the new year, as the case may be, to allow them to take that kind of minimum amount of time. And again, most provinces, with some exceptions, will allow for employees to lose the greater benefit where one is provided. That is the gratuitous amount of vacation that's given over and above minimum employment standards. So for example, say you provide your employees with 5 weeks of vacation and you're in a province that allows you to have a use it or lose it policy and that policy is in place and enforceable, you can legally take away any excess at the end of the year if they don't use it. Now, the primary reason why you have a use it or lose it policy is to encourage employees to use their vacation in the year in which it's earned. It's not necessarily meant to be a punishment. And if that employee has worked kind of very diligent throughout the year and has a reasonable request to push the vacation into the following year, that is something that you might want to consider regardless of the policy. Regardless of the policy. And that can be done on a case-by-case basis for employee relations purposes. And we have a best practice here to highlight this issue. We always recommend that We audit an employee's vacation time taken to ensure compliance with minimum statutory requirements in the province where you operate. And if you do allow employees to carry over some or all of their unused days into the next calendar year, you're going to want to have a record that shows that those days are the carryover days from 2018 in case you are audited by the Ministry of Labor.
Okay, next scenario is regarding inclement weather, which of course is on its way. There is a terrible snowstorm outside and one of our employees has called in to say they cannot get to work. We do not have to pay this person for the day. True or false? So this one is true. There is no legal obligation to pay employees for time missed as a result of inclement weather because this is not a request based on accommodation of a protected ground. So it's not one of those protected areas under human rights legislation, so there's no obligation to pay. Employees might be able to work from home, however, at the company's discretion. So if you allow for that, that is a possibility. So they could be paid if that is in fact the case. They may also opt to take a vacation day if it's approved or a personal day where it's available in order to avoid an interruption of earnings for that day. Employees who are permitted to work from home for the day should be paid for the time worked, as we said. And employees come into work and are sent home by the company. In the case where they do actually make it into the office and then we decide to close maybe and send everybody home, you need to be mindful of the reporting pay rules applicable in the provinces. So certain provinces will have what we call the three-hour rule where we need to make sure that there's a minimum amount of pay given to the employee where we send them home. So just make sure that we are being mindful of those rules by jurisdiction. As a best practice, we would recommend drafting a communication to employees regarding our expectations of them in the case of inclement weather. So, for example, who do they need to notify if they feel like they can't come in? And are there roles where working from home is going to be possible and permitted? So in the case of inclement weather, would we allow certain positions to work from home to avoid coming out in the snow, for example? And if in fact that is the case, we would recommend setting out as well what are our expectations of employees working from home, so in terms of communication, for example, and just reinforce that the same hours of work are going to be expected of them regardless of if they're in the office or at a home office.
So for some of our clients, this time of year may be a slow time of year, and they may decide that it's best that we kind of close our doors for a period of time, and this scenario here is going to address that. So in this scenario, we have decided that we are going to close this year between Christmas and New Year's. We don't have to pay any of our employees for the days we are closed. Now, is that true or is that false? And so this is true-ish. It's not all the way true and it's not all the way false. So employers are permitted to cancel shifts technically under employment standards legislation, provided they give employees the required amount of notice that's required thereby. And so employees will still be entitled to statutory holiday pay for any of the holidays during the closure, provided they meet the eligibility requirements of provincial employment standards legislation. So that would probably cover three of the days in most jurisdictions. Now, without getting too technical with you, there is an argument to be made that by refusing to allow an employee to work, you may have triggered a temporary layoff depending upon the jurisdiction. So, for example, in Ontario, there's a percentage actually outlined in the Act that says if someone earns less than 40% of their earnings in a given week, that counts towards a week of layoff. So you want to be mindful of that. Practically speaking, most employees aren't going to allege an improper temporary layoff. It's going to be more of an employee relations issue, and that's why we outlined some best practices when you are going to be closing over the holiday season. The first thing is to communicate in writing with your employees well in advance of the upcoming holiday and the potential closure. We also want to be sure to let employees know whether they are going to be paid or unpaid for those days. And if they are going to be unpaid, we should be giving them the option to use any available vacation time or personal time and may be available to them so they don't suffer an interruption in earnings. And a little bonus point here, if you're going to have an annual shutdown, and some of our clients have a year-over-year shutdown, it's a great idea, not just a good idea, but a great idea to communicate that in the employment contract itself, kind of setting out what dates roughly you are going to be closing. Obviously, it's going to vary from year to year, but a general sense of the closure, whether those days are paid and unpaid, and how that all shakes out. You can also build some flexibility in there in terms of whether or not you're going to be offering it year over year, and that it's subject to change, et cetera. But if it is something that is a common occurrence, it's good to let the employee know off the top. I think we have a question here. We're just taking a look, quick look to see if we can answer it now. So there's a question here that kind of has, I guess, like a variable answer here. It says, any issues with making the employees use their vacation time? So I assume they're talking about using their vacation time during the shutdown. And so in most jurisdictions, an employer has the right to schedule an employee's vacation. And so as long as you follow the rules in terms of, A, how much notice you must actually be providing them with when you are scheduling that, that could be a number of weeks in advance. It does vary from province to province. But you need to make sure that you're complying with the advance notice obligation in terms of scheduling the vacation. And also certain provinces have a requirement that the vacation be in 1 or 2 week blocks. And so you might run up against an issue there if you're only closed for the week and some of those days are going to be covered by the public holidays. You may not be able to technically schedule someone for 3 days of vacation during the year. And again, we should address these issues individually for sure, but if we are going to be having an annual closure, it is a good idea, and I have done it before in the past where we speak to the vacation entitlement and that there will be certain days that will be scheduled during the company closure. So just keep that in mind as an option.
Okay, we've got a few scenarios here based around holiday parties.
They're not all fun, I guess.
They're not all fun. These ones have got that. There's a few different areas that we want to hit on here. This time of year, obviously, there's parties going on, there's alcohol involved, and, you know, people's behavior can change. So we want to address a few scenarios in that regard. So first one here relates to sexual harassment. One of our employees made a complaint about being harassed. This happened outside of the office at the company holiday party last weekend, so there's nothing I can do. True or false? This, of course, is false. If you have been a part of any of our Respect in the Workplace trainings or seen the Respect in the Workplace policy or just generally, just a reminder, the holiday party is going to be considered to be an extension of the workplace. So the employer's responsibilities are going to be the same if harassment takes place there as if the alleged incident actually took place in the physical office. So what that means is that all formal complaints need to be investigated. The legal definition, just by way of reminder for you, of sexual harassment is a course of vexatious comment or conduct that's known or ought to be known to be unwelcome. While it generally involves a pattern, this is what we would usually tell you when we're talking about harassment, generally speaking, that it's going to be a repeated incident. In some cases, one incident can, in fact, be serious enough to amount to harassment. So, I mean, typically, the conduct at a holiday party, for example, might fall into that one incident category. So it might still be considered harassment based on the situation. So inappropriate behavior, obviously people are perhaps drinking, there's a little bit more uninhibited behavior at the company holiday party, suggestive remarks happen, compromising invitations, unwanted physical contact, things like that. So best practice in terms of how to mitigate this risk as best as possible, remind employees in advance about our expectations of them. So in terms of their behavior, what we're expecting of them prior to these events. And remind them as well of the Respect in the Workplace policy and what that means, and that policy is still going to apply to their conduct at the holiday party. And then just internally as well, be aware that these formal complaints that are made still need to be investigated. So if you need to, speak to the complainant, the respondent, any witnesses, you would go through that process for any incidents that take place at the holiday party, same way as you would if they took place in the office.
We have another question, lots of questions, which is great. So just keep them coming. The question was, if December is a busy month for us, can we tell employees they can't take vacation that month? And that is going to be true. You absolutely are permitted to have a blackout period in terms of when people can take their vacation. As an employer, you do have the discretion when to approve and when to disapprove someone's vacation. However, I do recommend as a best practice, if you are going to have a blackout period, that is communicated to employees well in advance, because we don't want to come up against a situation where we tell employees who have available vacation time to use and they're subject to a use or lose a policy on November 15th. We tell them, oh, you can't take any vacation next month. They're going to be inundated with a bunch of requests to take vacation in the last few weeks of November, for example, or we're going to be running up against potentially running afoul to minimum employment standards in terms of allowing someone to take their minimum vacation time and pay. So if we're going to have a blackout period, which we are permitted to do, it is a best practice to give employees as much advance notice of that practice as possible.
Good question. We should have made that a scenario.
I guess next year we'll
next.
Yeah. So on a holiday party, part two. Oh, there's one more.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, sorry, question.
One more slide here on sexual harassment, just to get into best practices a little bit more. To reduce possible claims, like we talked about, provide training to managers and employees on sexual harassment in the workplace. So that respect in the workplace policy, if you have that from us, that's something that you can provide training on. Review those policies and communicate them to employees, and make sure you're following up on any complaints. In terms of some things that you can do, some tips to maybe avoid the behavior altogether, consider inviting significant others. We see people bring their significant others to holiday events. They tend to be on their best behavior, or at least better behavior, generally speaking. Avoid traditions or games, things like mistletoe, twister, anything that's going to require personal contact. It should not be a part of your holiday party. And make sure that you've got a professional or business casual dress code in effect. So again, just to maybe avoid this type of behavior, these type of complaints, make sure that we're implementing some of those procedures. And just as well, on sort of a similar note, in the event that there's a complaint made the night of, the party, for example, best practice would be to never terminate on the spot, right? We want to make sure that we're following the complaint and investigation process, doing, our interviews, speaking to witnesses, et cetera, and making disciplinary or termination decisions, whatever applies, once that investigation has taken place, once we have the context for what happened, and taking into account, of course, any possible human rights issues. So just avoid that gut instinct to terminate on the spot and make sure we're following that investigation.
Now on the second part of on the issues that may arise during your holiday parties, I apologize to Christy. I was a bit eager to talk about workers' compensation. we always are. In this scenario, obviously some people can get hurt from time to time at these parties, even though we may exercise our best efforts to avoid that. In this scenario, though, we have one of our employees has suffered an injury at our holiday party. Luckily, the injury took place off-site, so I have no involvement or obligation as an employer as it relates to a workers' compensation claim. Unfortunately, that is not an accurate statement. Accidental injuries that take place at a company holiday party, even if they occurred during off-duty hours and away from the regular workplace, may be compensable under workers' compensation legislation. In most cases, to be considered compensable, an accident must meet two conditions. It must arise out of and be in the course of employment. And there are a number of decisions out there that speak to this issue, that there are off-site events that employees participate in that have given rise to compensable claims. Now, ultimately, whether it's compensable or not, is going to be dictated by the workers' compensation kind of body in your province, but it's something to be mindful of. And so we're giving you some best practices on how to limit some liability associated with injury that may be sustained at holiday parties. And so the first one is going to be to ensure that your company insurance policies will cover holiday party activities in the case the accident is not covered by workers' compensation. So that's important, because if workers' compensation does not apply to either your industry in general or to this particular incident, the next question then becomes, are you liable as the employer in an action under our law of negligence, meaning you failed to meet the required duty of care you owe to your employees, and because you failed to meet that duty and someone was hurt as a result, you could be held liable for that. It's also a good idea to kind of review the venue and the situation and anticipate any accidents or injuries that may arise during the holiday party. So we're probably going to want to avoid any physical activities at these parties, especially if alcohol is involved. Just be mindful of those and try to limit those as much as possible while still allowing people to have fun. And we also want to ensure that managers know and understand their ongoing supervisory duties, even at the holiday party. So what this means is it's always a great idea to have at least one or more, depending upon the size of your workforce, a dry manager, someone who is not drinking at all, who is responsible for overseeing the safety of the event, ensuring that people aren't over-consuming as reasonable as possible, and ensuring that people are not driving and everyone has their appropriate taxi chips, et cetera, and we'll get to why that's important in a minute. But again, let's make sure we have one or more employees, I'm sorry for those employees, that are dry and have to be there to supervise what's going on.
More holiday party downers. So this one has to do with discrimination. Our company is holding a Christmas party next Thursday, and everyone has to attend. This is fine because it's meant to be social, a non-work event, and so I can't get into any trouble. Of course, this is false. I mean, employees may raise claims of discrimination as a result of the actions of the company prior to, during, and following a corporate holiday event. So it might be inadvertent, but by calling it a Christmas party, for example, we might be excluding certain groups who might take offense. And this is a legitimate legal issue, a legitimate religious objection. So in this particular case, in this scenario, the fact that we were calling this a Christmas party, you know, planning it as a Christmas party, advertising it as a Christmas party, and all of the, you know, specific religious tradition that goes along with that, and also the fact that we are requiring employees to attend at that party, might give rise to claims of discrimination.
And I must apologize, I may have even called it a Christmas party earlier in this presentation. I don't know. It's a reasonable mistake that people do make, and so we just want to prepare you for that. So.
Right. I mean, it's like I said, it's completely inadvertent, and it's not necessarily intending to exclude certain groups, but it might have that effect, and you know, they might take offense to it. So something to be aware of. Also, you want to note that making any work event mandatory may give rise to an obligation to pay employees for their attendance. So best practice is to always make sure that that is not mandatory. We don't want to force people to attend. A few other best practices here to avoid possible claims of discrimination. Generally speaking, be sensitive to the diverse backgrounds and beliefs within your company. So if we can call it a holiday party and, you know, not, you know, avoid decorations and celebrations that reference any particular religion. So, you know, no Star of David, nativity scenes, things like that. Try to keep it more to the Frosty the Snowman type decorations, let's say, that are not linked to any particular religion. Want to make sure that the events, of course, are inclusive and non-denominational. So phrasing is important. We want to make sure that we are framing it as non-religious. So just keep that in mind when you are communicating, you know, the invitations and any details about these parties. And then, of course, making sure that these events are not mandatory. This is another example as well, just in terms of discrimination, of the importance of not terminating on the spot. So, and the human rights potential concerns that come along with that. So, you know, for example, if we had an employee who was drinking too much, we decided to terminate them on the spot. There's the potential, perhaps, that we are discriminating on the basis of a disability. So if they had like an alcohol dependency issue, for example. So just another example of why terminating on the spot is not appropriate. Important to investigate and make sure we're gathering all the information that we need and deciding on the best course of action from there.
And our last, a bit of raining on your holiday party parade, so to speak, scenario relates to this idea you probably heard of called social host liability, and I referenced earlier a duty of care, which relates to the law of negligence. Without getting too technical, there is the possibility of being liable as a social host, or there are things that arise from that. So we have a scenario here, and then are going to wrap it up with a very scary, kind of sober reminder of a holiday party gone wrong. So we want to avoid that scenario. But in this year, we're having our holiday party at a restaurant off-site. This way, I don't have to worry about our employees drinking too much or driving while impaired. This eliminates my liability should anything go wrong. That is the wrong attitude to have, because that could result in some liability for your organization. Obviously, employers who allow employees to consume alcohol on their premises or in connection with a corporate holiday event off premises expose yourselves to substantial liability. As noted, under workers' compensation, there could be a workers' compensation claim. There's also the possibility of a negligence claim or other potential claims as it relates to workplace harassment, etc. So you want to be mindful that there is some potential liability with these holiday parties, because liability can arise both from the actions of your employees while attending the company function, but also after they have left the party. And so we have to be mindful of if our actions give rise to their actions after the party, we could be held liable. Now, there's two potential types of employer liability in this scenario. There is the provider liability, so the liability associated with providing, serving, or making alcohol available to a person who they know or ought to know is already intoxicated. And so that, again, is one of those reasons why you want to have someone who is a dry manager to keep an eye out for that stuff. Now, we do note that no one in Canada has ever been held liable for serving alcohol, providing alcohol in a reasonable manner. So if we're being reasonable, we shouldn't have a problem. If we have a manager who's dry and they're doing their job, we shouldn't have a problem. If we're using smart serve people, also shouldn't have a problem. So any employer would be considered a provider of alcohol supplied under its liquor license or under a special occasion permit that was obtained in its name, and if the event is held at a licensed restaurant, then the restaurant would be considered the provider, even if the employer paid the bill. So if we can limit our liability somewhat by having it at a restaurant, because they are the provider, they would be providing people who have smart serve, etc. The second part of liability is occupier liability. And so this is liability for alcohol-related injuries that occur on or in relation to the event host property or rental property. And so depending upon the terms of the rental agreement you may enter into with the facility, the employer may be considered an occupier or a co-occupier of the event space. Now, reserving tables at a restaurant would not make an employer an occupier or a co-occupier. However, again, we need to stress that there is going to be some potential liability if we're not restricting the consumption of alcohol of our employees. And we have a bunch of best practices that, if we're not going to mention them in the slides to come, I'll recap them at the end of this, but it's something to be mindful of. And now Christy's going to go through the worst case type of scenario so we don't make the same mistakes that have been made before.
So we have an example of a case that we probably cite often on calls with you guys, just of, like Alex said, the worst case scenario. So in this case, there was a holiday party being held at the office, and the receptionist was expected to attend and had duties to carry out during this event. So, you know, she's cleaning up, she's got things to do while the party's happening. She became visibly intoxicated. Her manager did notice and, you know, multiple times told her that, you know, they were going to call her husband if she continued to drink. But they didn't, in fact, do anything about the fact that she continued to drink. So they took no steps to actually stop her from drinking in the next 2.5 hours or to prevent her from driving. So nobody actually followed through on that threat to call her husband. Nobody called a taxi. Nobody took away her keys. Nobody sent her home in a carpool. They didn't take any steps to prevent further damage there. After the work party, she drove to a bar and had 2 additional drinks. And got in an accident on the way home. And in that accident, she suffered permanent physical and cognitive injuries. And the court actually did find that the employer was 30% negligent for this employee's action. I made a couple of comments on that decision here. So they found that the employer had a general duty to safeguard the employee that it extended beyond the confines of its office. So we talked about that extension of the workplace. The employer also had an obligation to ensure that the employee did not get so drunk while working on the premises as to interfere with her ability to get home safely. So we could have either prevented her from drinking or got her a safe way home, which the employer failed to do. The court also noted that the employer should have actually demanded her keys or taken steps to protect her. So whether that's sending her home in a cab, calling her husband, like we said, calling the police, whatever it is, to not let her drive home, whatever it took to get or to prevent her from getting behind the wheel. The court was also critical of the company for setting up an unsupervised self-serve bar. So if we've had discussions with you guys probably in the past in terms of best practices, having a self-serve person doing the service, drink tickets, you know, any situation where the employee is not actually doing the service, pouring their own drinks, that's something that the court was critical of in this situation. There was nobody monitoring, no dry manager, as Alex has talked about, monitoring the alcohol consumption. We had no idea how much more she had to drink. The company had no idea how much more she had to drink after she had been warned. So just something in terms of best practices to keep in mind, the court was critical of that setup of the actual bar at this party. And we know this is probably a difficult position for the employer. I mean, you don't want to tackle them to take their keys away, but what you want to do is make sure you're putting in controls so that this doesn't happen. And we'll talk about some examples of what those controls can be on the next slide here. So best practices. In terms of the, I mean, first and foremost, something that you could consider would be to have an event that is alcohol-free. So maybe something different than the standard, you know, dinner and drinks or dinner and dancing, whatever the case is, but maybe a holiday brunch or lunch where there's not actually alcohol involved. So that's one option. If you do decide to serve alcohol, I mean, first and foremost, don't provide an open bar. That hopefully is obvious based on the case we just talked about. You want to always make sure you've got non-alcoholic drinks and food available. You want to make sure that we are monitoring alcohol consumption and restricting it. So maybe we're giving out drink tickets to make sure that nobody gets beyond a certain number of drinks in them, or hiring a third party to serve drinks. Like Alex talked about, they will likely assume a lot of the liability because it's, you know, their role, they're trained, they're smart served, whatever the case is. Best practice, again, issuing a memo reminding employees ahead of time that, you know, this event is, or this party is still a business event and all of these policies still apply. So we still expect employees to maintain a certain standard of behavior. It is not a license to conduct yourself in a manner that's inconsistent with our policies. Remind employees as well that they need to be responsible in their consumption of alcohol if in fact we are serving alcohol, and encourage them to make alternative arrangements to get home. So we might provide that transportation home, for example, so taxi chips being made available prior to or during the night, or maybe making it known to employees that we would be fine with them expensing the cost of a cab or an Uber as per our business expenses policy, but these would be best practices if in fact we are going to be providing alcohol.
And right before we wrap up today's presentation, we have two more wonderful questions, and so I'll tackle those first, and then we'll kind of hit the bow on this, and we'll call it a year. But first question from one of our clients is, we hold an awards night on a Sunday evening when all our stores are closed. We ask that everyone attend unless there's a reasonable reason for not attending. We're not paying employees for this, should we? Well, this raises a couple interesting points. Now, I'm not going to ever recommend necessarily whether you should be or should not be paying for someone for a social event. What I can say is that if you are making it seem as though attendance is mandatory at an event, whether that is a dinner out with your clients or something else that's mandatory, like an awards show, there is the potential that someone could claim wages for that event. And so you could decide to either loosen the language a little bit in terms of you can encourage people to attend, but not make it seem like it's mandatory, and go that route. Now, obviously, keep in mind, some employees aren't necessarily entitled to be paid for that. So if they're exempt from hours of work, et cetera, you don't need to pay. But the ones that are not exempt, there is a possibility. Now, I would probably go forward in this kind of more social scenario. This isn't a staff meeting per se, which absolutely would attract an obligation to pay wages. I would probably not be paying. I would maybe make it a bit more loose in terms of mandatoriness, but if you don't want to do that, I'd probably just maybe go forward with it and know that there is the potential that someone could claim wages, even though in your view it is a fun event for everyone to attend at. So just keep that in mind. And the last question we have for today is, what if employees bring their own alcohol, and I assume they mean to the work party? Well, we're going to not allow that. I'm going to indicate probably upfront that if it is a BYOB event, I would probably not have that type of event, at least not when it's organized by the employer. You're going to want to be able to be in a position to control the consumption of alcohol, again, whether that's through drink tickets or having a smart serve kind of person there. I would discourage any BYOB event. Now, if they're acting outside of the parameters and it's not a BYOB event, but they're bringing their own alcohol, if that is discovered, I would clearly indicate to the employee that A, I'm disappointed, B, it's not appropriate, and if they choose to consume that, they're going to have to leave our party. I wouldn't let them leave the party with the alcohol if they already seem intoxicated. That could lead to some liability. Now, if you don't know about them having the alcohol, there realistically isn't much you can do about it. But again, I would discourage BYOB events for sure. You can't control consumption there. And I would also advise you to probably put a stop if people pull out their own alcohol at an event where you are also serving alcohol or that is a dry event. So to wrap up, I know we covered a lot of stuff, and unfortunately, I would like to be able to say that we made up at most of these scenarios and that the answers are always kind of clear, but they're not. Oftentimes, these are actually ripped from the headlines, so to speak. These are questions that we do get from time to time. Obviously, the law is not always clear, and so it's always good to seek some additional clarification, and these are common misconceptions. So we need to be mindful of these around this time of year. Some of these apply throughout the year, which is great, but some are really, really, really timely right now. So you want to keep in mind these issues. And if you have any particular questions about these issues or any other holiday year-end type issues, we are here to help you. If you also want to draft an employee communication for your holiday parties, we are more than happy to help you with that as well. That's one of the first steps to avoid or reduce the likelihood of liability. And lastly, and perhaps more importantly, we want to wish you, on behalf of the to our staff here, a wonderful holiday season and a very happy new year to all of you. You guys make us what we are, and we really appreciate you. And we will be back for another e-learning in January. So again, thanks on behalf of everyone for a great 2018.